play we can go is recognizing that it is a traditional medicine. It cannot be monopolized. It belongs to everybody. And setting up palliative care systems. So what can cannabis do for pain and palliation? I basically have broken it down into three categories. It's really quite straightforward, and there's lots of evidence in each of these areas. Number one, palliation of symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, pain, spasms, loss of appetite, and I think depression and anxiety that accompany serious illness. These symptom clusters have been very well studied in palliative care populations who are using cannabis under medical authorizations. In multiple countries, both here in Canada and in the U.S. in controlled trials, and in Israel, where they've actually integrated cannabis into oncology centers and inpatient wards where patients are receiving, even children are receiving pediatric chemotherapy. They have vaporized cannabis available in inpatient wards. So we've gathered a lot of data in actual patient populations that cannabis is effective for the palliation of these symptoms and does lead to a reduction of use of other drugs that would otherwise treat those symptoms. I can give you some of those numbers if anyone's interested. I published an article in the journal Current Oncology where I reviewed some of those studies. For example, there was one that was done at the in Haifa at the Rambam Healthcare Campus. 8-week study, 131 cancer patients. And they noted that all cancer related symptoms, vomiting, mood disorders, fatigue, weight loss, anorexia, constipation, sexual function, sleep disorders, itching, and pain got better after 8 weeks of use of cannabis. Also, reduction in the dose of opioid pain medications in 31 of 70 patients who had used such medications. They weren't all on opioids. And a reduction in the dose of antidepressant or anxiety drugs in 1/3. And I won't belabor all those details. You can look up that paper, Current Oncology. It's open access. The second cluster that cannabis is effective for and can be effective for in palliation is the palliation of spiritual and existential suffering. And this is certainly a area that borders a lot of the crosses borders with a lot of the issues that this conference is focused on around spirituality and health. And these issues are very, they're not just sort of theoretical extra layer thinking in palliative care. These are the most important issue that you have to address to relieve other symptoms. Spiritual distress can sometimes manifest as untreated severe physical pain or severe anxiety. And not talking about issues around end of life and mortality, you're not going to be able to serve that patient or that family. And I think everyone here will know that the benefits that cannabis could provide: euphoria, aversive memory extinction, sensorium enhancement, and spiritual insight catalysis. Those could play a very important therapeutic role for patients who have faced severe, multiple traumatic treatments, such as radiation, chemotherapy, surgery, all the things that happen when people are still doing aggressive care at the end of when they're facing serious illnesses. When they're facing, you know, their own mortalities. And I think there's a very nice quote. I'll have to close here soon. There's a really great quote from William O'Shaughnessy, who was the doctor who first described cannabis into Western medicine in the 1830s when he was working as a surgeon for the British in Calcutta. And he had treated a gentleman who had rabies that had spread to his nervous system. And so that patient could not swallow or drink anything without having a severe vomiting episodes. And so O'Shaughnessy started giving him a few milligrams of basically a cannabis extract capsule every couple of hours when he came to his chamber. And he described how this guy who had been completely dehydrated, completely was suffering, was started to start started to eat some orange peels, some juice, some food, and started to kind of calm down and relax. And he ultimately died in his ward, in his clinic. And I think this is a first example of a modern hospice treatment for a patient with kind of a dosed approach of cannabis. And he said, it seems evident that at least one advantage was gained from the use of the remedy. The awful malady was stripped of its horrors, if not less fatal than before. It was reduced to less than the scale of suffering which precedes death from most ordinary diseases. Next to cure, the physician will perhaps esteem the means which enable him to, quote, strew the path to the tomb with flowers, end quote, and to divest of its specific terrors the most dreadful malady to which mankind is exposed. I would say maladies. There's multiple maladies like this now. But this writing just showed to you the eloquence of these 19th century physicians who understood that a great benefit to provide people relief when they're facing such severe symptoms. And if cannabis can do something for that, my goodness, what are we doing? We have to have emergency access. The final area is experimental use of cannabis for, as they said, Hail Marys. And we need clinics where cannabis can be experimentally administered under, hopefully, medical guidance. Because patients like that have multiple medical issues that need to be partnered with. And I would love to see that those kind of regulations take place where cannabis and medical health professionals can be in the same room with the patient and help them, guide them in a dosing strategy and initiation and use, and follow those markers over time and not put that burden on patients, because that's a violation of their right to health. I look forward to talking to you on the panel.
Thank you, Dr. Agarwal. Thank you so much for that all-important work that you do. We are all going to be there one day. And I know that when it's my time to go, I want cannabis right there alongside with me. Yeah. All right, so now we're going to have our panel. And are you going to introduce Donna? Yeah, she's actually our moderator. Oh, yeah. I'd like to introduce to you the moderator for this panel. Which is all about patient care. So, Donna Johansson is a consultant with Cannabis Education. She is self-employed as a business consultant since 2012. With 30 years of business and education leadership, her work with the government at both the provincial and federal levels earned her several commendations for innovation and public service excellence leadership. In recent years, Donna has conducted research and studied cannabis in Canada, discovering that incorrect information has been disseminated to citizens for decades. It's a shocker. As an advocate for lifelong learning and a facilitator of change, Donna engages with businesses and individuals to advance the transfer of cannabis knowledge, facts, and information through educational initiatives. She is passionate about sharing true, fact-based information and supporting our human right for access of this amazing cannabis plant. Please welcome to the stage Donna Johansson.
I would love to see that.
Good morning. All right. Hello. Good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Ms. D, for the kind introduction. And good morning, everyone. Are we still morning? It's an absolute honor to be here on the panel today for the patient care panel. And also, I want to say that it's been a wonderful day and a half so far as a participant here at the conference. An incredible amount of learning, an array of experts and specialists, and it's just been a fabulous couple of days. I want to thank personally Salome for organizing this fabulous conference. So our patient care panel today are going to be addressing some of the major issues that we've been talking about in the last day and a half about patient care. And also, we're going to touch on some of the issues around holistic health. Can you hear me? Is that all right? Okay. So we're going to start with Dr. Spooner, the far left of the panel here. Dr. Spooner is the owner of the Paradigm Naturopathic Medicine and currently in private practice in Vernon, British Columbia, the Okanagan, where we're from. And he's received his ND from the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine in 1998. Dr. Spooner sits on the board of directors of the College of Naturopathic Physicians of BC and is adjunct faculty at the University of British Columbia, Okanagan, and the Boucher Institute of Naturopathic Medicine in Vancouver. In 2003, Dr. Spooner accepted the position of postdoctoral fellow of environmental medicine at the Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine in Environmental Medicine Center of Excellence. After completing his fellowship in 2005, he continued instructing at SCNM as an assistant professor, teaching courses in toxicology, environmental medicine, nutrition, and supervising student clinical rotations at the Southwest Naturopathic Medical Center. While at SCNM, Dr. Spooner was instrumental in developing the Wellness Center in the Phoenix Fire Department Medical Center. So, Dr. Spooner, in your practice, you address patient health concerns and treatment plans, providing a bridge between conventional and complementary medicine. More and more people are seeking cannabis as treatment as they learn about the healing qualities and want to pursue it for their wellness. How do patients begin a conversation with their physician about medical cannabis? And also, if you can discuss a little bit of some of the misconceptions that you hear from your patients and concerns that they would address with their doctor.
Thanks for the question there. So I'm a small town doc, practice up in Vernon. I don't have all the luxuries of here in Vancouver, and so it's always really quite intriguing to come down here and see the availability to any number of different types of resources. So some of what I may explain when we talk about cannabis in a small town context, you guys in Vancouver here may look and say, well, really, that's a problem for you? But I think it's something that you really kind of need to acknowledge. You know, basically for a naturopathic doctor, we operate in a very gray area. Most people don't recognize that naturopathic physicians cannot prescribe cannabis. Many people will come to us and ask for us for the confirmation of diagnosis, but because of the legislation and the way that it's written, legally, we're not able to do that, and if we do so, we're liable to run into problems with regards to possibly being charged for facilitating trafficking. So those of us that start having the conversations with patients on this, we run into a very interesting situation, because when, as Dr. Agrawal mentioned, talking about traditional plant-based medicines, most people, or a lot of people, will look at naturopathic doctors and say, well, that makes sense. They do herbal medicine, so why not talk about, you know, the herb? Yeah. So this is the thing that we have to try and navigate as we begin our conversations with patients, and how do we start to facilitate, and how do we help them create a comprehensive care program? And so, you know, where we start to try and go with that is actually trying to build some rapport with our medical doctor colleagues in our communities. And we start and try and provide, you know, basic resources for them, trying to provide references, trying to have a conversation. But when you sit down, again, you know, and start talking with the patients that I see, most of them have heard about it from friends. You know, they're like, well, I've got, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, and somebody gave me a tincture. I had one of those on Friday, actually. I said, well, what's the tincture? And I don't know, I haven't tried it yet. I go, where'd they get it from? Well, I don't know, they made it for me. I go, what strain did they use, you know? It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, so these are some of the initial things. So many of the patients that are coming in have absolutely no concept of THC is actually different from CBD. So we have to engage in that conversation. And we also have to look at trying to have that conversation with their medical doctor and helping them start to understand the differences there. Because surprisingly, many of them don't have that clarity on that as well, too. I see many patients. I have a very large integrative cancer care program. I see a lot of patients for chronic pain, and I also see a number of patients for inflammatory bowel disease. Each one brings its unique aspects of it. I find the inflammatory bowel disease patients actually respond very well. That one's fairly straightforward. For our chronic pain patients, those get more complicated because we see a number of different types of medications that are involved with that and trying to navigate that conversation and figuring out. And again, that's where we have to start having a conversation about, you know, an endocannabinoid profile or what's most appropriate for them. And then finally, we deal with the cancer patients. And these are probably the most heartbreaking ones because usually the people that come and see me are the ones that have tried everything else. And usually what I end up seeing is a lot of times patients will come and see a naturopathic physician after they've been fired from their family doctor because they've been difficult patients or non-compliant. And so, you know, we're stuck in this interesting quagmire where, you know, we have a medication that potentially could be at least very, very useful from a palliative standpoint, if not from a treatment standpoint, but we have to run through a series of different barriers to run through to in order to help patients access that. But the one big thing that we really see from a standpoint for cancer patients is, you know, this is going to cure my cancer, isn't it? And I can never say that because every cancer situation is different. Every tumor is different. And so how you respond and deal with each one, you don't know. But ultimately, end of the day, you know, you have to roll up your sleeves and get to work. And to be able to use cannabis as a tool is certainly something that, you know, needs to be, you know, made more readily available. And the understanding to help build on that is definitely where, you know, I certainly try and help expand that.
Thank you. And any comment? Thank you. Any comment in terms of the naturopath guidelines for prescribing? What are the current rules for that?
So again, from our college's standpoint, and you have to understand, you know, when you hear about medical doctors and naturopathic doctors, you know, I know many patients express extreme frustration about their doctor won't understand that. Now, it's because our regulatory colleges represent the public, and as such, they're beholden to the law as it exists. And unfortunately, because cannabis without access through licensed producers right now is still illegal, the college can't sanction the use or the access through anything other than the Health Canada mandated guidelines. You know, and whether we would like to or whatever is the law at this point in time. And what happens is that if at some point in time we were to go beyond those bounds, we could potentially be cited, we could be brought before an inquiry board, and we could have a disciplinary hearing and cited for a misconduct and even possibly charged. And so it's a frustrating area, and I think it's important that patients really do understand that there are many doctors, and I've talked with many medical doctors and naturopathic doctors, that are frustrated, as frustrated by the situation as patients are. But our college, because the law is the law, and our college demands, it's required to follow the law, we have to follow it. So the guidelines are basically the Health Canada guide mandated. And I'm sure Terry's got some comments on that as well, too. But
thank you, Dr. Spooner. Okay, so moving along to Terry. Terry was introduced a little earlier and as previous. Terry is president of the Medical Cannabis Resource Center. And in his introduction, he's recently done talks in Australia to the College of Physicians and a number of talks across Canada to HR groups regarding medical cannabis in the workplace. And I'd like to pose to you, Terry, can you speak about some of the issues that you address to your clients with regard to questions they have about using cannabis in their workplace as part of their medical health, and how that's received, maybe some of the rights that we have as citizens to using cannabis, and issues that come up within workplace?
Well, cannabis in the workplace seems to be the largest segment of interest that we're getting now from the public and from the workplace. The predictions are 50% of the people that will be going through the medical marijuana process will be working in the workplace. And we're going to see this grow more and more in the predicted amounts of patient flow that we're seeing. It's going to be very relevant. It's already happening at this point. So a lot of times, typically will see a patient, they will not volunteer this information. There are certain regulations within the labor code that deal with impairment, and cannabis is the same sort of a thing. You cannot be impaired on the job, even though it's legal to possess it or have it. It's the same thing. You can't, even though alcohol is legal, you can't be impaired by alcohol. And even if you're using pharmaceuticals and you have impairment, it all falls underneath, interesting enough, section 420 of the labor code, stating that you must declare if you're impaired or you're using something. So I don't know if that was an inside joke when someone did it, but whatever, we find it pretty funny at that point. So typically what will happen is we'll have a patient that's been caught smoking marijuana. He will tell his employer that he has a medical license, and they won't know what to do with it. They think, well, this is rounds, that's illegal, we can fire you. But the bottom line is they can't be terminated for that use if they're medically viable. They certainly can be sanctioned or written up if they're impaired, but typically what we do is we will work with, if a patient has that type of issue, we've been through this a number of times where they have been put on notice and they were being fired, they have come back to talk to the HR, our physicians have gotten involved, created a health plan, and we work with the HR group so that this individual can work while he's using cannabis. Now, there's a number of different things that we'll do in regards to that to assist those patients. Right now, there's over 250 strains that are available through the licensed producers. A number of LPs have very low THC and high CBD type strains that can be used for patients needing that kind of relief while they're working and not have the impairment. If they are going to use the impairment, there's a mandate of 6 to 8 hours from when they've used it before they can actually go back to some kind of a safety-sensitive job. And there are different levels of safety that you have to be more aware of. For instance, someone we've talked recently to the RCMP and VPD about marijuana in the workplace. They have high rates of PTSD, and a lot of their members are now using cannabis but are really unaware of what they can do. We don't want a cop being stoned out of his mind with a gun on his hip. So that is a very major safety issue. An engineer that's working on something very structural, he can't be impaired because the calculations he's going to be making are very relevant and very important. So there's a number of different areas that require more oversight for that particular patient. But there are a number of different products out there that you can get your medication benefits and not be getting the psychoactivity. And that's a lot of what we'll do when we talk to the HR groups. They're asking those information. They want to have some standardized protocols of how they can determine if that person is impaired and the steps they go throughout it. So we just really mirror those type of steps with the traditional impairment type protocols for alcohol, pharmaceuticals, or anything else. And they just go through those same processes if they found someone with cannabis. And we will talk with them and come up with a healthcare plan. So that's kind of been a very up-and-coming issue, and we see that's going to be much more relevant as we move forward and more people are getting into the medical cannabis side of it.
Well, it's great to see and hear that kind of discussion going on within HR in Canada, and I imagine it's an issue that is going to be on their agenda in coming years as well. Yep. Absolutely. Thank you very much. And Dr. Agarwal was just speaking, and I have a question for him as well. Dr. Agarwal is a physician scientist, medical geographer, and multi-care Auburn Medical Center in Auburn, Washington, palliative care medicine physician and associate medical director. He also has a website if you want to go have a look and check out a number of his presentations that he's done. It's called www.cannabinologist.org, and he's published over 24 peer-reviewed articles and chapters. Dr. Agarwal, holistic health care considers the whole person, body, mind, spirit, and emotions in the quest for optimal health and wellness. Can you discuss cannabis for holistic health, and what are some of the research priorities there?
Yes, I think holistic health is a very nice model, and we also are talking about integrative health, integrative medicine in the United States. The National Institutes of Health, and it's kind of the Canadian Institutes of Health is sort of modeled after their sister organizations, but they have created a National Center on Complementary and Integrative Health. That's the new name of NCCAM, National Center on Complementary Alternative Medicine. So the integrative health concept is enshrined in a health research priority at the NIH. And hopefully that concept, which includes holistic health, ideally it comes from an idea of blending multiple different forms of medical practice. So naturopathy, allopathy, osteopathy, massage, acupuncture, whatever works, which we can blend together so we don't have to be in these silos, because cannabis really does cross multiple medical systems. That's just what it is, and that's why we hear so many different models, because people use it in different medical systems. So a research priority would be, how health services delivery. How do we actually deliver cannabis holistic care with cannabis integrated? If what kind of outcomes are we getting if a patient is getting it from one doctor and then going to a separate doctor who authorizes their cannabis? Does it cause the two system, extra expenditure for the patient, extra travel to clinic time? Is it actually making them, is it actually helping both doctors do their jobs better, the one who's more specialized? Or do we need to move away from a specialized model and have cannabis integrated into the primary care? Well, and if we do that, what kind of education is needed? I mean, those kind of things are, health services is very tough right now with cannabis because of the lack of knowledgeable people. But there are centers, and those centers should start to engage in that kind of work. There was a very big study that just came out on health expenditure in the United States, where $16 million was saved in Medicare dollars. That's federal money for prescriptions in states where cannabis was legal for medical purposes in the U.S. for certain conditions. That kind of research is very nice, and it starts to show that there's this integrative approach. I'm also very interested in cannabis growing and therapeutic gardening. I think people don't appreciate enough the value of nature and access to sort of... I worked at the first hospital that had a garden attached to it. It was in 1951 that was called the Haupt Garden. It's at the NYU Medical Center. It was actually blown away after Superstorm Sandy, the hurricane that we had a couple of years ago. But that was the first place where we actually had a garden in a hospital. And I would prescribe for patients who had strokes and brain cancer, a spinal cord injury, time in the garden with horticultural therapy staff. And they would work on, there was some animals there, there was koi pond, there was things that they could plant and things they could work with nature. And we found, a lot of research has been done there showing benefits in terms of mental health and rehabilitation and recovery when you're working with something that's growing, and then you also are dealing with growing your ability to walk or talk back. So, I mean, cannabis is a plant. Why not utilize that plantine side of it? And what kind of benefit could there be had in integrating exposure to cannabis agriculture with cannabis as your botanical medicine? That's another priority. And the spiritual stuff, I definitely. There's a lot of interesting research in spiritual health and well-being coming up now, scales of spiritual health and well-being that should be applied to, I think Dr. Walsh, who was speaking previously, is coming up with a scale of cannabis use, which integrates some of these, questions, and that'll really help us understand these other wellness benefits that we know make big impacts for overall health. And then the experimental research side, that's very ripe, and we can talk more about that in Q&A.
Thank you very much. We happen to have a few minutes for questions. Should you wish to line up for the podium there and ask a couple of questions of our group? If not, I'm going to continue on with a couple that I have. Well, one of the questions that I have is... what would it look like in the future, and I'm talking 5 to 10 years perhaps in Canada, what would be an ideal scenario for patient care access in Canada? Would you say if we're on a really good path of serving our patients, We clearly understand right now it's a bit of a mash, and people don't know where to go. They don't know who to talk to. If we're building a system, a new patient care system, tell me some of the elements that it would be involved, what it would look like. Anybody?
Well, we'd like to see it something similar that what we've created now, and that was the rationale behind starting MCRCI, was to do exactly that. When we started back, we started looking at this in about 2007, and what we found was there was such a lack of knowledge from doctors that we would talk to the patients, they would go to their doctors, but still not have enough information themselves to convince the doctors or have the doctors be willing to support for them. And so that was really why we started it, was to create a specialized location with knowledgeable doctors that would not ostracize the patients for coming in and talking to them about it. And we've seen that. We've seen other doctors that he had mentioned being fired from their doctors. We've seen numbers of situations like that. And so an ideal situation would be, if it can't be integrated so that it's typical medicine for every doctor, instead of, you know, offering painkillers, they would use cannabis, to a specialized model where they have a specialization in cannabis. So just as they do in arthritis or anything else, that for those specific things to do with cannabis, those would be areas of expertise that certain groups would continue to build on. Now, we've seen from when we started in 2010, being one of the first clinics in the country, to seeing probably 3 or 4 dozen of them around the country now. So the model that we're talking about is already in place. And over the last 2 years since the MMPR has come into place, we've seen the model that we were working with start to explode to create that specialized care. So I think if we were to look at something, we would see that continue, but have more medical doctors being part and parcel of it, and more education overall in the medical schools, so that even family physicians will have at least the basic knowledge that they'd be able to support the patients rather than having them send them there. But in more extreme cases where you would need more, you know, cancer, epilepsy, things like that, you would have the specialized areas that would be able to focus on that.
Dr. Spooner? Oh, did you want to comment?
Well, I think the key thing here is putting the patient first in this whole process. You know, and what's really needed are, in my mind, are follow-up care and someone who's familiar with the case, and so that you can make sure that you're adapting as the situation changes. And in consistency and access to product, you need to be able to provide patients products that are working for them, and be able to know that we can get that same product again. So ideally, you know, as a naturopathic physician, you know, I carry a dispensary in my own clinic of herbal-based medicines and things like that, you know, and so we operate on a model that I think would fit really nicely with what's going on for cannabis clinics, which is long-term patient interaction, holistic care with easy access for the patient. And ideally, we're doing that. It's just a matter of, you know, how do we work that forward, and how do we integrate naturopathic doctors into this system that what Terry's talking about.
I would say I got a definition of health from the WHO. Does everyone remember the WHO says that health is the state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not just merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So we have to health care is to achieve that for every person in the population. So for cannabis, I don't want the patient to have to worry about how much is this going to cost me. I don't want them to worry about, is this going to affect my credentialing at my workplace. I don't want them to worry about, you know, who the heck am I going to, you know, I'm stressed out because I can't find it. That those social, psychological, economic issues have to be reconciled with you. And the only way you're going to be able to build a system around that is if you start from, you know, patient's perspective. You know, I've got this issue, and I want you know, easy, reasonable help for it. I really think, based on cannabis science, we really need easy access to multiple variety ratios of cannabinoid terpene profiles. I mean, we kind of know enough to get a sense, okay, it's something about CBD-THC ratios and something about CBD-THC to certain terpene profiles, myrcene, limonene, pinene. And I'm not saying that we have it all figured out, but those are the building blocks to figure out how to tailor things to specific patients. Ultimately, we'll need also to get a sense of people's endocannabinoid systems. If you can do that from physical exam or history, that would be nice. But sometimes even lab data, people are trying to test what is your anandamide level in your bloodstream, and people have developed some tabletop testing. It doesn't have to be super high-tech, but if you really want to think about cannabinoid integrative medicine, the field of cannabinoid medicine, you have to think about endocannabinoid system, you have to think about cannabinoid ratio compounds available, preparations in various formulations, oral, edible, you know, the whole gamut, inhaled. And certainly you have to think about holistic health, not just cannabinoid care, but if they got good cannabinoid medicine, but nobody's doing their regular other checkups, like their dental care or their other care, you know, that's not, we're not doing good health care. And Canada has a good health system that's primary that needs to be built, could be built down nicely with this. So I really feel like if we had a place to go, like Dr. Spooner is saying, one-stop shop, where you could get that kind of varieties on site with a doctor, if you need that guidance, that would be great. But I think the state needs to really be more involved. I'm sorry to say, private interests are always going to be focused on their bottom line first. That's the nature of business. So you have to have social medicine, social framework to help the poorest, most disabled, most marginal person in the population who has a condition that could be helped with cannabis. See if you can figure out a system that helps them most easily, and then just generalize that.
Thank you. And it looks like we have one person up for a question. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Terry, you touched on this a little bit, but I want to ask about the medical schools. And the general practitioner or the family physician is usually the first point of reach for people to go in and talk to them about this. So I'm just wanting to ask you, with your work, are there any medical schools that are, now that cannabis is becoming legal in Canada, and a lot of information is out now on medicinal benefits, are there certain schools or even countries, you were in Australia recently, that are going to be approaching this with their GPs so people can have more direct access as opposed to this ambiguous kind of, oh, can't touch that right now?
Well, as far as we know now, that's not happening yet. There are small segments of the endocannabinoid system, but most of the students that we'll either talk to or will come and visit to get some information from us, from UBC, we do a bit of a mentorship program for third-year students. They have not heard anything about it. They're stepping out on their own to find out this information. Now, doctors such as these that are now trying to proliferate that kind of information are starting the first steps in what we need to see here for that to move forward. But the colleges and the medical system are very slow movers. And even though the medicine and the information we're getting now here is really piling up and coming fast, it's a lot longer to get the old school thoughts of those organizations to move forward at the same pace that we're seeing results in things. So I think it's an eventuality, but it's going to need some serious input from outside doctors. Again, that's what the PMC is trying to do, is to come up with initiatives and papers to the colleges to help push that forward and put that whole agenda forward.
Thank you. We have time for one more question, maybe about a minute or two. Please go ahead.
The last questions are very good, and I want to emphasize that and ask a little bit further to Dr. Agarwal, perhaps, or anyone else on the panel. You know, it's about this question of physician education. It just isn't there when you come to cannabinoids and all the details of it. And so how do you change that? And my question is, you know, it's accrediting agencies that govern the medical profession. So do you believe that we have to somehow get to these accrediting agencies and require them to require that cannabinoid information is included in their curriculum at an early level? For example, internal medicine, you know, considered the backbone, the Bible of medicine, is governed by, for decades, by two textbooks, Cecil's Textbooks of Medicine and Harrison's, published every 2 years, as you know. And if you look in Harrison's up until 2005, or Cecil's, there is nothing more than maybe a paragraph about cannabinoids, and it has to do with drug abuse or drugs of abuse, right? And that hasn't changed. So we need to get to the writers and the contributors of Harrison's and change the basic education material that we're being required to use. And perhaps it's the, do you believe that the accrediting agencies are the way to do that, or yes. What would you suggest?
Yes, I do believe the accrediting agencies. In the U.S., it's the American Association of Medical Colleges, AAMC, and then the AMA's Council on Medical Education. Those two set the curriculums for medical school, MD and DO, medical curriculums throughout the country, and all schools have to adhere to those standards. I'm sure there's something similar in Canada. My former dean at the University of Washington, he became a dean at Thunder Bay, Ontario Medical College. And, you know, I remember talking to him, this needs to be in the curriculum. He's like, yeah, I'm all for that. I know there's deans who will see that. And they just, sometimes the public needs to push. Just like in the era of HIV/AIDS, there was no good education. All doctors were afraid that they couldn't take HIV patients in their clinics, and you know they would fire them. And then you know HIV patients started throwing their medicines at the NIH campus and had big protests and die-ins. And it forced the system to shift. We have to care for these folks, destigmatize them, and you know make them a priority. And now we have we have drugs that HIV patients allow them to live instead of dying. And there's still issues there, but I'm just saying there's a public pressure to throw themselves into the system like that. And I don't think there's enough pressure been put on those systems enough by the public, and they will have to yield to the public demand for this. Yeah. So I think that's a good systematic approach. And there are textbooks now with cannabinoid science. People have really started to integrate this stuff well. And I think we just, it is in the original textbook of William Osler. You know, he was a Canadian physician, and he's the father of internal medicine. Several editions had cannabis, and I make a list of several top doctors, Charles Gower, and Dr. Reynolds was mentioned yesterday by Dr. Hanus. There's a few major names who basically brought hemoglobin checks into medicine, ophthalmoscopy into medicine, the modern study of epilepsy into medicine, and of course, Osler did everything, rounding. Anyway, so cannabis is part of the allopathic lineage too. So it'll help them to get into it. That's why I mentioned those things, so to make them feel that this is not just the latest fad. So I would please encourage you to write to find the body that accredits, and if they don't accept cannabinoid medicine as part of the curriculum, then they need to it needs to be called out.
Great. I'll just add a little bit here as well too. Actually, just jump in quick. So the mandate of the regulatory colleges is to protect the public. Okay. And so what that means is that I know in our naturopathic college, one of the things that we do is we create certification processes for up-and-coming therapies. So for example, we've done intravenous therapies or prolotherapy, and when the college started to recognize that there was a demand for this and that there were people doing it without proper accreditation, a certification process was needed. You know, for naturopathic doctors to get prescriptive authority, we just need our Ministry of Health to submit under the Reserved Substances Prescribing Act to the Ministry, to the Health Canada, and we could add naturopathic physicians into that. You know, and that's a fairly straightforward process that the legislation exists for. And then at that point in time, a CME program could be worked out with that, then becomes an accreditation process. And that actually is something that happens very quickly.
And unfortunately, with the medical, the MD side of it, it's not quite as simple. In fact, one of our esteemed MCs, Dr. Dave Hepburn, has put together an accredited course. What had happened here, there had been two accredited courses. He put one out. A month later, they rescinded that. They took that accreditation away. They have now put a moratorium on, I guess probably 6 months ago, another 6 months for further research. And yet you would be at a doctor's conference, they would be asking questions about cannabis, and the last time we were there, the registrar of the college was there, and she got beat up pretty badly on stage from the doctors saying, this is a federal program, we're being put in the place that we have to support it, and yet you are now rescinding and not allowing accredited courses that give us that information. So that's something that's happening currently within the BCMA right now.
One last thing. The general comment 14 on the right to health, it's a violation of the right to health to, for states to deliberately withhold or deliberate withholding or misapplication of any information, health information, relevant to health. So you can cite the state, you know, under your charter, human right, deliberate withholding or misinforming of information relevant to health.
Fascinating discussion, and I think we could go on and on. We are, however, out of time. We'll have to stop with the questions at this point. I do want to thank our panel who have brought an incredible amount of information to us today, excellent knowledge and skill base. Thank you very much, and thanks to everybody for attending.